This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Phantasm. Is it a nightmare? Phantasm. Is it an illusion? Phantasm.
We're at downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 63, Phantasm, or Phantasm, or whatever syllable you want to emphasize. This is the classic from 1979. This is a minor masterpiece from Don Coscarelli.
Yes,
incredible.
Indeed. Yeah, no, Phantasm is one of those... Well, I mean, look, Phantasm has a lot of fans, and I'll say fans...
A lot of detractors, too, but...
Right, but when I say...
They're wrong.
When I say fans, I'm going to say it with a PH.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Phantasm fans, right? But, yeah, I guess it's not quite as embraced by the mainstream as, like, you know, your Nightmares or your Friday the 13th.
Yeah, your Halloweens, yeah.
Maybe part of that is because of the fact that it is very low budget. Maybe another part of that is the fact that it's a very sort of inscrutable, illusory, dreamlike, non-linear film. But as far as I'm concerned, that works to the credit of the movie, not the debit. Is it safe to say this movie is not, you know, your typical, let's say, go from A to Z movie, and there's a lot of, like, I don't get it in this movie.
Yeah, and part of that is a result of the original 3.5 hour running time being cut to ribbons, and what you're left with is something that's maybe a little bit less than coherent.
Well,
but
no, I mean,
adds
that,
to the
that's
it
the whole
contributes
thing.
Right? To
I,
the
yeah.
Know.
When I said that, I said, is it, you know, is it safe to say? And the reason is because, as you said before, this movie. I mean, when Coscarelli first made his film. It was the cut was over 3 hours, and of course, that's not a commercial horror flick. It's like, you'll never have a 12-minute pop song,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, true enough.
And so, so he basically cut it down to half, to an hour and a half, and what ended up happening is huge subplots got ripped out. Huge motivations for characters, resolutions for characters.
Yeah.
And you end up with this movie... It operates on this dreamlike level all its own, and a lot of movies, like if you would take a movie and say, okay, this movie, I want you to cut it down by half, and I want it to make some coherent sense, and I want it to be entertaining and to have some value, impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible. This makes somewhat coherent sense,
yeah.
But it is damn entertaining, and it does have lasting value. I mean, for some reason, for as much as this film... doesn't quite, you know, connect the dots.
It makes up for it in all sorts of subtext, some of which we'll describe here.
And atmosphere, and just a lasting feeling of dread, which this film has. So yes, we will talk about a lot of subtext. I mean, this film is rich in subtext.
It's a coming of age story.
It is.
And concomitant with that is, as an adolescent, and we'll talk about the protagonist here, the star of this film is a teenager. You're powerless, you're not an autonomous being, you have no credibility, no one believes you, you're basically in debt to, and you're limited by, adults.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case here, you have this protagonist who...
Michael,
whose responsibility it is to take on this evil demon from an otherworldly alien demon.
Mm-hmm.
And he I guess it should be said, he grows up real fast in order to deal with this.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, you know, I guess we could say Michael is, like, they only say he's 8 or 8. I guess we'll assume he's, like, within 13 to 15, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. So he's an adolescent. That's like being in limbo, because you're not a kid.
No.
And you're not an adult. You're sort of right there in the middle, you know what I mean? And
not yet a woman, like Britney Spears.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's true, because, I mean, as a kid, you know, people sort of believe you because, oh, you're a kid and, you know, like, okay, well, you know, we got to protect our kids. And when you're an adult, well, you have your own autonomy, right? But when you're an adolescent, you're just sort of there. And, mm-hmm. you know, you're...
You have no identity. Yeah.
Puberty, and you're pimply and confused and horny, and you don't know what the fuck is going on with your body.
Yeah.
You don't know what the fuck is going on with your life. And, you know, you look to your adults to
provide guidance
and protect you. Sometimes those they don't provide the correct guidance. In this case, there's not even a parental figure.
No,
I mean
the parental figure have both succumbed to their injuries, and yeah, I guess it was a car accident.
Right, the parents shoved off the motor coil, and they're no longer alive. So now his guardian is his brother Jody, mm-hmm. who is very much an absent guardian. I mean, there's very little real interaction between Jody and Michael. There's another parental figure, a character by the name of Reg, played by Reggie Bannister, who's friends with Jody, and he's an ice cream man.
A little too old to be an ice cream man, but similar to Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Or, other film features ice cream?
Well, there's a film where Clint Howard, the brother of Opie himself, Ron Howard, plays
a killer ice cream man.
It's called Ice Cream Man. And, yeah. I mean, there's just something inherently hilarious about that white suit with the black bow tie.
Yeah.
Just like Clint Howard, Reggie Bannister, the actor who played Red.
He's less than hirsute. He's got a bald, faultily challenged,
you know. But, I mean, you know, so there's a subtext of adolescence. There's a subtext of, like...
How we deal with death.
How we deal with death.
And that's an excellent segue here, because in the first scene we have the third member of this trio.
Right, Tommy.
Yeah, Tommy, he's part of this musical group that comprises, again, Jody and Reg. Mm-hmm. And he is in a cemetery, and he's got this chick with him, and he's banging her on the tombstone. And, you know, right in the throes of passion, you know, he's about to come, but he's not coming, he's going. Because a dagger emerges from this woman, and she rips it right through his rib cage and makes mincemeat of poor Tommy. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, this old man's visage replaces that of this attractive topless woman, mm-hmm. which freaked us out. And yeah, strange sexuality right from the get-go.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, Coscarelli was, I guess, either commercially minded enough or generous enough to show a nice pair of mammaries. But,
yes.
You know, so, you know, if the audience, any titillation from the audience disappears immediately in the face of Angus Grimm.
Well, it would have disappeared with a knife, surely.
Well, I don't know. Knives can be sexy, but Angus Grimm, no.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk a bit about Angus Grimm. Angus Grimm plays the villain.
The
of this
villain,
film.
Yeah.
The tall man.
He's a mortician.
Yes, he's a mortician. An undertaker. And I mean, this is, you know, Angus Grimm, his real name is Lawrence Rory Guy. And in some of his early film roles, he's credited as Lawrence Rory Guy.
Yeah.
Although, not an appropriate name for somebody with the, you know, creepy visage of Mr. Grimm.
If you pull back the curtain, i.e., the Scrim, mm-hmm. you get, you know, this the genesis of his name comes from his theater work. So Angus Grimm, you know, he cuts an imposing figure in the film. They put him in suits that were several sizes too small, like a bad bar mitzvah suit or something.
Yep.
And, you know, he's 6'4". They put him in platform boots to make him even more imposing.
So he's 6'7".
He's 6'7", and his weird, scary, near rigor mortis kind of creepy pale face,
and not just
superimposed over
moves,
this
the way he walks, everything,
superimposed over this attractive woman as her lover is being murdered in the cemetery. Whoa, mm-hmm. That's incredible.
Yeah, so I mean, when he actually worked with Coscarelli before, and then when Coscarelli wrote the script for Phantasm and said to Mr. Lawrence Rory Guy, I'd like you to
I need you to play
him.
An alien,
and he goes, I think I'm gonna use the Angus Grimm
name,
for this one. Yeah, and I mean, because of the success and notoriety of Phantasm, he's been Angus Grimm
forever since. Yeah.
And it's such an incredible name. It's so apt. I mean, you know, it reminds me of Max Schreck. It's like in the, you know,
yes, the Schreck means terror.
The German played Nosferatu. Yeah. There's a lot of conjecture about that actor himself, that he was actually a real vampire. But it's an incredibly fitting name. And anyway.
And our second introduction to this incredible tall man mortician character is through, obviously, the funeral service. Again, mm-hmm. this is the best friend of Jody, Michael's older sibling, and they mourn the demise of Tommy, who, it was said, died of suicide, which is ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the town just says, well, what a shame that he took his own life. And
yeah. No further investigation required. Yeah.
And so it's funny because, I mean, I guess there was a band comprised of Jody, Reg, and Tommy.
Tommy.
Now so they were Rush. They were a power trio.
Now they're a duo, yeah.
But poor Michael, I mean, you know, back to our adolescent Michael, he's not invited to the funeral, but he's an inquisitive guy. And
true.
There's this incredible mausoleum. Very, I'm going to say
very Kubrick-esque.
Kubrickian, mm-hmm. Fulci-esque, excuse me, for always referencing Fulci, but it just seems whenever there's something inscrutable, it's Fulci-esque.
Yes.
And at one point, this hand just, like, grasps his shoulder, and he looks up in this imposing, looming figure, and there's a tall man, goes, "The funeral is about to start, sir."
Yes.
And like, we're like, okay, this guy is not...
Something is not right.
Something is amiss. So, you know, while Reg and...
And Jody are mourning their buddy.
Burying their buddy, mm-hmm. Michael is sort of snooping around, and he sees something very unusual. He sees the tall man, instead of burying...
Tommy. He takes the casket and single-handedly throws it into the back of a hearse.
Mm-hmm. And he basically sees what's going on. This is a nefarious plan of the tall man. The tall man is actually an alien.
Yes.
And he's got this plan to...
steal Earth's
Rob
bodies.
Graves. Yeah, sounds like Graves. Plan 9 from Outer Space. Like, to steal, you know, Earth's corpses, but instead of reanimating them like Plan 9, I guess that was the 8th and the 7th and the 6th just didn't work out, so they didn't, you know, they had their 9th plan. That's actually a Seinfeld joke, but anyway, it still works, right?
It still works.
You know, he wants to basically shrink them down into these slave dwarves and, through some sort of dimensional portal, bring them back to his planet where they're going to...
Yeah, it's not really well explained.
No, but it doesn't really matter.
No.
Anyway, the point is, Michael is on to...
to the tall man.
The tall man. Now, again, we talked about being an adolescent, being, you know, having no authority, no agency,
no autonomy.
Nobody believes him. Mm-hmm. He's not only does he have to try and convince the townsfolk that some real evil shit is happening, but now he's got the tall man after him.
Yeah.
Boy!
Yeah,
you know?
Boy.
The tall man is ready. You know, he wants to, you know, get him. And he has to convince Jody. He has to convince Reg. He does manage to convince through...
take some physical evidence. Mm-hmm. So while he's, I guess, exploring the mausoleum, he has a mano-a-mano encounter with the tall man. And he barricades himself in a room. Tall man sticks his hand through the door. Mikey has got a little knife that he's brought with him for such an occasion as to, you know, provide self-defense. Lops off the fingers of Tall Man. Tall Man oozes a yellow custard kind of substance.
Yep.
And Mikey procures one of his fingers and puts it in a little box and takes it to his older brother to show him as evidence.
Yep. And then we see this finger still moving in in a pool of custard. And, something. And then
his animate finger. On the stairs, he's showing the older brother that, you know, this is what's happening, and he finally believes him. Later, when Reggie shows up to their house,
mm-hmm.
the finger morphs into an insect or something. I can't remember if it was that or something emerges from the sink. Either way, some creepy creature emerges and affixes itself to Mikey's scalp.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no disbelieving him now.
Yeah, well, okay, so another theme that's explored in this movie is that of fear and the getting over thereof. Because, I mean, as adolescents, as kids, I mean...
you fear everything.
You're scared, you know?
Yeah.
And especially, it's interesting too, because, I mean, puberty is a very scary time. I mean, your body is changing in ways that, you know, you could be quite profoundly disturbing to yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, Cronenberg's The Fly. A lot of people think that, well, that's allegorical of like the AIDS virus, and it is, but it's also allegorical of puberty. Like all of a sudden you're developing hair.
Yeah, or the Wolfman, for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, so he's afraid. He's afraid of many things. He's afraid of losing security of the only parental figure he has left, which is Jody, that Jody's going to leave. He's also afraid of now the tall man that's after him. There's a scene early in the film where he inexplicably visits a psychic woman and he has to put his hand in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, the more scared he is, the more pain he feels. And then, as he releases his fear, the pain lessens.
Yeah, is attenuated, yeah.
So he basically also, you know, and that comes into play later on through some sort of parallel device, which leads to the portal, which we're not going to get too far into, because it does get a little convoluted.
A little convoluted, yeah.
But it's, the you know, getting over your own fears is another theme that's explained in this movie. What is real and what is in our imaginations? There's another scene where a bit of a peeper, our friend Michael, he sees his brother Jody stripping the very same lady. She's now referred to as a lady in lavender by fans of the series.
In the same cemetery?
In the same cemetery, which makes me wonder, is there not a motel in this bloody town?
No, like, back seat, nowhere to go, no make-out point. Mm-hmm. And he's got binoculars, he's hiding in the bushes, and he's watching in this very Freudian sense. I guess his father figure brother stooping this woman in, you know, amidst the dead. You know, a little insulting to the deceased.
No, but I mean, but this woman, this is, that we keep seeing, I mean, it's been basically surmised that this is the tall man. I mean,
yeah, he's inhabiting the bodies of the living.
So I mean, so eventually he convinces Jody and Reg that, you know, the tall man is
out to get them. Yeah.
Out to get them, and not only that, but what the tall man is doing is he is basically robbing the graves, and it's going to sound very bizarre. Turning them into dwarves.
Yes.
And yeah, so they get turned into these dwarves, which basically resemble the Jawas in Star Wars. Now, this is not a ripoff, because they were conceived
prior.
And they just sort of came into the world at the same time. And they're supposed to be brought back to the planet that where the tall man comes from. They don't really explain
where. Don't say what it
and,
is.
And work or do something. Extremely, extremely bizarre. Very Italian, very surreal. And again, like, what is real? What is going on? Weird and convoluted and strange. There are two things I have talked about this movie that, in particular, two aspects in particular that make it so effective. The first being the music.
Yes.
Talk about the music.
Well, yeah. You know, we've discussed in previous podcasts our affinity and affection for the likes of The Beyond, City of the Living Dead, The Thing. Our Exorcist. Some of the most iconic, incredible music.
Tubular Bells, Michael Oldfield.
Yeah. And this one, you know, I forget to whom it's ascribed, this quote about what, you know, the notes you play in music are just important as the ones you don't play. In this, the music is so effectively used in the scenes that it is, and so effectively omitted that it's really amazing, because you can overdo it. And you can underdo it as well. It's as we were talking about this earlier, it's definitely a lost art. I can't think of a single soundtrack, with the exception of some independents, that resonate with me as much as the Italians.
Well, it's not just the Italians, but I mean,
the Fritzis and the Goblins.
Okay,
and all
so you have the Goblins, you have the Fabio Fritzis and stuff, but also you have, you know, your Morricone's a thing.
Yeah.
You have Carpenter's Halloween score. You have even Harry Manfredini doing the iconic Kiki Mamma, you know, in Friday the 13th. In Friday 13th, we mentioned The Exorcist, Tubular Bells. I mean, in many ways, I mean, when you know, when it comes to fright, a lot of times people, they think about, you know, the visual aspect of it all, the gore, but they forget about the auditory aspect.
Yeah.
That alone is very important when it comes to creating an effective, scary movie. soundtrack is incredibly effective and incredibly languid, incredibly surreal, and incredibly evocative. One of the better horror soundtracks.
Yeah, in the top 10 for sure.
Now, we also have to talk about, I mean, when people think about Phantasm, they think about the sphere, the weapon.
I guess Razor emitting silver bauble that's telekinetically, you know, sent around by, you know, obviously, well, telekinetically, the mind of Tallman.
Mm-hmm.
And it spears the forehead of, I believe, one of the other, I guess, morticians in this in the Morningside Cemetery, and just digs deep into his forehead. The blades turn into drills, and the guy starts bleeding like a stuck pig. Really
yep.
incredible. One of the all-time great,
blood, yep.
One of the all-time great horror weapons. Although I've not seen it. You mentioned it to me that I've not seen them. That in sequels they make further use, arguably more abuse of this device.
Yeah, yeah. They gain different abilities. Mm-hmm. They become bigger. They become more deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And as one character in Phantasm 3 likens it, there it's basically a flying Christmas tree ornament. But
yeah.
What a deadly flying Christmas tree ornament it is. Another thing I want to make mention is that, once again, Angus Grimm. I mean, the Tall Man is an incredibly scary character. Unlike, let's say, Nightmare on Elm Street, we have Robert Englund with the burnt pizza face makeup,
yeah.
or the iconic mask of your Mike Myers or your Jason, you just have
an old man.
An old man who's incredibly frightening in his body language,
right, yeah.
in his physicality, his appearance. I mean, forget about the fact that he's physically imposing, but I mean, he's completely, like, just with like a raised eyebrow or a scowl, or Angus Grimm is able to...
Yeah, he inhabits the role almost like a throwback character from the 40s,
like a
Karloff or a Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah, he would even be, with his physicality, with his facial expressions, he would not be lost in a silent movie.
No.
So,
it's amazing that a character came to this prominence who was an erstwhile TV writer and liner notes writer for music.
He's won a Grammy Award for winning liner notes. Unfortunately, an unfortunate hairstyle. There's a couple unfortunate hairstyles in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
One being Reggie Bannister's.
Yes, yeah. His mullet, sort of receding hairline, ponytail.
Receding? Dude,
no,
it's gone.
He has it's receded, like the
his
tide.
His bald pate.
Yeah,
you know?
James Taylor.
Yep, and... The hairstyle of the Tall Man, Angus Grimm.
Yeah, very much like Pulp Fiction's, Julius? John Travolta.
John Travolta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible. Just amazing. And would instill a fear of skinny ties in you as well. Just an incredible look overall of this Tall Man. Because kids are inherently scared of old creepy guys. Like, there's a phrase, creepy old man, for a reason.
And especially when, you know, this old creepy man goes, "You play a good Game Boy, but now you die." You know? Boy! And which is really funny because, when I revisited this movie a couple days ago in preparation for this podcast, and I'm watching the credits, and it says, "Best Boy," and I'm thinking, "Best Boy!"
Now, when you play the Game Boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold them. Okay, Kenny Rogers reference?
Kenny Rogers and Phantasm. Never thought I'd hear it spoken in the same breath. But anyway.
And it's weird to hear the phrase Game Boy and not relating to Nintendo in any way.
Super
interesting.
Super Mario
Brothers,
yeah? Game Boy!
Game Boy! Yeah, this is
a boy named Sue.
This is an incredible movie. I give it 4 stars all the way. It is aged gracefully, like your Sophia Loren. I mean, my God, this is so much better than I remember it being.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive the grammar there, but this is really incredible. What would you give it?
I'm going to give it 4 stars too. I've seen it a couple times before, and I think that it's actually grown in my estimation. It's become better. The more I see it, I guess, the more, the less that I require, you know, things to be actually explained to me, and the more I'm willing to accept a bit of ambiguity in my movies, although I've always been willing to accept ambiguity, but maybe in horror, I don't know. I think the last time I saw Phantasm was maybe 7 years ago. Revisited again in preparation for this podcast. I've now been in the midst of a Phantasm marathon, and I've watched all the sequels. But, I mean, the sequels become a lot more straightforward, a lot more action-oriented. They're fun, they're entertaining, they're great, but there's something about this original that is incredible.
Well, what did we learn?
What did I learn?
Well, I'll tell you what I learned.
Okay.
I must have lived a sheltered life, because as an adolescent,
as a boy,
I was not armed with a buck knife roaming around cemeteries with binoculars, spying on people having sex, driving around a cemetery on a motorbike, fighting off evil, otherworldly alien creatures with an older sibling trying to save humankind. Mm-hmm. I lived a pretty mundane life in the suburbs of Toronto, I guess. You know, like, no, what can compare to this kid? What did you learn?
I learned that with, let's hear it for the boy! I think I've now beaten this boy to death. But anyway, it's still kind of funny. I might make it one more, but anyhow. I learned that when you're living in a small town and there's a nefarious plot involving portals to the other world, only 3 people know about it. And only 3 people are doing something about it. No authorities are involved.
No
FBI. No forensics.
No, just
no
members of a crummy band and an ice cream truck driver.
Yeah.
That's it.
And so what I've learned is never underestimate your ice cream truck driver because he kicks some major ass. And
he definitely does.
If you watch Phantasm 2, 3, and 4, he becomes an unlikely action star. Sort of along the lines of Bruce Campbell in Evil Dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I learned.
And check out our site as well, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.